main system. We added impurities, and now we're adding interactions. Let me say that I see that I'm not always getting to the end of my notes and not calculating everything all the way. I'm posting my notes online every time. Now I gave Dennis three lecture notes for the three lectures we had, and then every time I'm going to update it. I don't want to give it to you in advance, because only after I give the class I know that, you know, I need to omit some things or stuff like that. And sometimes you'll find that there's a bit more, like from yesterday, there's a bit more material in the notes, just because I didn't calculate anything yesterday. So you can see that as a, you know, bonus of the notes. And also, please, I know that for some of you, what I'm saying is relatively trivial or familiar from other things. For others, that might be fast, so feel free to come and talk to me about, you know, even something you just didn't quite get during the lecture. I think it's much easier than later on trying to figure out what I said. So interactions, you covered a little bit in John's course. And basically, what you wrote down is an interaction term, which was quite general. And then you broke it up you used expectation values, and you did self-consistent Hartree-Fock. So today I want to use Hartree-Fock. I'm not going to do it self-consistently to make it simpler, but in principle that is definitely required. Yeah.
Yeah, I just want to ask, in the Hamiltonian we wrote for graphic,
yeah,
we consider the nearest neighbor interaction.
The nearest neighbor hopping.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What happens if we consider the next nearest neighbor?
Okay, that's a good question. So basically, the next nearest neighbor doesn't do much, or a small next nearest neighbor doesn't do much to the bands, and you still have pretty good Dirac cones. What it does is actually it gives some dispersion to the edge states. So do you remember that we found basically in the second class that we have a flat band of edge states? The second nearest neighbor interaction is kind of important in that regard, because it gives it some very narrow bandwidth. So instead of having this, it actually does something like that. And this is due to second nearest neighbor interactions. Second nearest neighbor hopping. So it doesn't do much. We are going to talk about something that effectively looks like imaginary second nearest neighbor hopping, which comes from spin orbit coupling, and that would actually be a topological insulator once you add that kind of second nearest neighbor hopping. But this is for 2 weeks from now. Yeah, does that answer your question?
Yeah, but I think the if we add this on the RSL,
yeah,
then the energy is not linear momentum anymore.
It adds a term, but if you go close to the nodes and that term is small, then the approximation, the Dirac approximation, is still quite good. Maybe another thing I want to say is that tight binding is just an approximation anyways. What you really have to do is work it out from first principles and see what do the electrons really do in terms of the potential, and it depends what is the shape of the potential, what is the shape of the atomic orbitals that are used here. Carbon has pi band, sigma bands. We're actually looking at p orbitals from the carbon that are in out of the plane. So this is the z direction. So they're almost spherically symmetric in the plane. And these are the ones that are relevant for the graphene at low energy. So there are many considerations to take. And it turns out that the Dirac Hamiltonian that we wrote, and you know, that comes from the first nearest neighbor, is a pretty good approximation to what you find if you do the first principles calculation. So that other T prime is actually not an important addition. Okay, another one? Another question? It's a good time now? Okay, so let's talk about interaction. So if you remember, you had a Hamiltonian that, let's say, was the kinetic energy plus some interaction. And let me write the interaction term in the following way: dr prime, v of r minus r prime, n of r prime. I think this is how you wrote it in John's class. And when we do the Fourier transform of it, we had kq, k prime, v of k minus k prime. I want to do another step before that. V of q, vq, nq, and minus q. This is just what happens from Fourier transforming. And here it is again, something that looks like a convolution in real space, looks like a product in after you Fourier transform it. And when I say n of q, I actually mean sum over k, ck dagger, ck minus q. So this will be sum over kqp, vq, ck dagger ck minus q, cp dagger cp plus q. And there are also indices. So whenever I have density, I have to sum over the spin. And in our case, we also have to sum over the lattice, the sublattice degree of freedom. So alpha is going to be A or B. So let me put alpha here. So I have sigma and alpha, sigma and alpha, sigma prime and beta, sigma prime and beta. And now what you did is a variational approach to mean field, which meant that you assumed some variational Hamiltonian that was something that we can solve, something that basically gives us a diagonal kind of dispersion, something like that, or actually we called it E. But we don't know this dispersion, and what we thought that the interactions would do is just change the population of different states, right? So we basically played with the density or the occupation number of different states. So this, the expectation value of this would be different in the new system, the interacting system. And then let me remind you that you discussed two options, two possibilities. One is that if we look at the ground state, it's just smoothly connected to the ground state of the non-interacting system. So I think you had a graph like that. So there were states of the non-interacting systems, and there was some parameter by which you turn on the interactions, and there were states of the interacting system, and there was some smooth evolution of the ground state from, you know, what it was before the interaction and with the interaction. Another option was that the state you started with evolved, and some, let's say this is the state you started with, it evolved, and at some point you crossed to another state. And that would be a state of a different symmetry. And this is often what happens with interactions. So the two scenarios are such. One is that I look at the interaction, and what I get is some renormalization of parameters. So I start, let's say, with free electrons. I have energy that it's p squared over 2m. Could be that I evolve my state, and this mass becomes some other mass, effective mass. For example, yeah.
Yeah, I think a very probably general question, though, if it will be appropriate to ask it now. So what's the purpose of having this term in the Hamiltonian? I thought that so all interactions, the advanced direction, have been already self-consistently taken into account.
That's right. So what I want to say is the following. If all this interaction will do is maybe change the effective mass, I don't want to bother even writing it. And of course, there are sometimes interesting changes of parameters that are not uniform on the Fermi surface and all of that. But if I can just encode it in some changes of parameters, I will just do it and write the effective theory. And then it all is a matter of taste, but I don't like to worry too much about these details. But sometimes, and I'm talking about this scenario, something more fundamental happens with interactions. So, for example, if we go to a different symmetry state, we might break a symmetry that we had before. Very popular kind of symmetry to break is SU2, spin symmetry. And often, and I'm going to talk about it in a second, this kind of term leads to ferromagnetism. So all of the electrons would like to be in the same spin state. Or maybe if it's not total polarization, there would be more spin up states filled than spin down states. And then I have a broken symmetry. I have a ferromagnet. It goes from being a metallic state to an insulator state. It's a phase transition. And I want to ask whether this interaction can cause this phase transition in graphene. But let me first motivate why this really happens in any system. So if this is my interaction term, what you did before was actually amounted to taking the expectation value of this interaction, so let's call it E int, is the expectation value of that four fermion operator. And taking the expectation value, you could have used the weak theorem to say that you can take it actually in pairs. And there are two kinds of pairs. There are two kinds. Two ways to pair it. One would be this way, which is the Hartree term. So when we don't exchange, so remember there are indices here, so there would be alpha here and beta here. We don't exchange, it will cause, I will have something like that, CK minus Q. So if this is the ground state, and I expect that momentum is still a good quantum number, I expect that if I take out an electron with k minus q and add an electron minus k, I'm not back in the ground state. So then that means that I have delta q equals zero. And this is the Hartree term. However, I can commute things around and take this operator with this operator, and this operator, I will need to commute it to actually get it. And that creates another term that just this commutation, which is canceled by the Hartree term. But it will give you actually minus sign. And let me just write it here. So, and I just want to call it the exchange energy. And I think you used this term in the previous class. The exchange energy is going to be minus sum over k and k prime, v of k minus k prime, and then these two things. So I'll have ck and q. Say ck. Sigma alpha, and now I'm writing all of the indices pretty carefully. C P plus or K prime plus Q sigma prime beta times CK prime, sigma prime, beta, dagger, C, K minus Q, sigma alpha. So it's called exchange because we had to exchange places. And now let's look at what happens here. And let me first discuss what will happen if we did not sum over alpha and beta. So assume there is no alpha and beta for a second. Then I'm looking at this. Again, from the same argument, this gives me a delta function of k and k prime plus q. This gives a delta function of alpha and beta. Sorry, no alpha and beta, sorry. Of sigma and sigma prime. And it will just be proportional to whether the state with momentum k is occupied or not. So it will just be 0 or 1. I'm thinking of 0 temperature to make it simpler. So basically, it is roughly, so let's say for a Fermi liquid, kind of, this would be V of k minus k prime, n of k prime. And I would have the same spin here. Now I'm, and this is negative. So now we have a competition between two terms here. The first term is just given by the kinetic energy. So the kinetic energy, Ek, Ck, dagger, Ck, how would that be minimized? So if I had no interaction, how do I minimize this kinetic energy? How do I have n electrons. How do I put them in the system? Should I put them, you know, all with spin up in all of the energies? Not a good idea, right? Because let's say I have some levels. If I start filling spin up, I'm going to get very high, and my Fermi energy is going to be pretty high. And the total energy is just going to be all of that sum. But if I put them like that, in the unpolarized way, my Fermi energy would be lower, and I think the overall energy will also be lower. So this term really wants to lower the Fermi energy. It wants us to just fill as little variety of states as possible. So in the Dirac system, for example, it means that if we have half filling, which means that one electron per site, and we have two n states, n in the lower cone and n in the upper cone, will fill only the lower cone. So this is what the kinetic energy wants us to do. I'm saying that the exchange energy wants us to do something else. Let me just say that the Hartree energy and the Q equals zero part and all of that is indifferent to how we populate the states. It just depends on the total density. So let's just forget about it for now and think about this term. So if I want to do a rough scale analysis, and this is not by no means right, but let's say that this goes like 1 over k, and this n is proportional to k squared, or kf squared. Sorry, so let's call that kf, because I only have one scale of momentum in the problem, so I'm just putting all of the k's to be k Fermi. This is just a rough analysis. Of course, you can always do this. This is just theta functions. You can always do this integral. It's a bit simpler in three dimensions than in two. But n goes like k Fermi squared, and then let's say I have n up, and I have k Fermi up, for example. So I would have here 1 over k Fermi up, let's say And then K Fermi up to the fourth. Okay, because this is square and this is square, or I can write it as N up to the 3/2. Okay, because I have K Fermi cubed. So this goes roughly like N up to 3/2. And the total energy, so it will go like N up 3/2 plus N down 3/2. And this term now is negative, so I want to maximize whatever is inside. And you can convince yourself that it pays off to have some imbalance of density, to have more spin up than spin down. So for example, if I put, let's take two cases. One is not polarized, so no spin polarization, so I'm thinking that there's no spin down, for example, and N, which would be N up plus N down, is going to be N up, so I'm going to have N to the 3/2. On the other hand, this is the fully polarized state. Everything is N up, okay? N up is equal to N. Now I want to do the other case, that there is no polarization, so N up is equal to N down, N is N over 2. So what I have is N over 2 to the 3/2, but I have 2 of them because I populated each state twice. So what I get is N to the 3/2 over root 2. So this is smaller by this factor exactly. So if I want to maximize this quantity, which is the absolute value of the exchange energy, all I need to do is polarize the system. So this term really wants to polarize the system. And actually, if you have an interacting Hamiltonian, sometimes there's some different scaling, and that depends on the dimensionality and on the interaction itself, different scaling for the kinetic energy with K Fermi or with the density, and different scaling for the interactions. But in general, when the interaction is strong enough, it will dominate and it will want to create an ordered state. So why doesn't it always happen? Why don't we have every metal that we know of, why isn't it ferromagnetic? Well, two things might happen. One, some other ordered state will happen. Doesn't have to be ferromagnetic. Ferromagnetic is just a simpler. If we have long range, sometimes other things happen. Or two, the interaction is not strong enough. Or it might give us an ordered state, but at temperatures that are ridiculously small that we cannot access. So we do have Fermi liquids. But when we have strong interactions, many things happen, and one of them is a ferromagnetic state. So this is common wisdom in condensed matter, that when people started to think about graphene, they tried to apply this common wisdom to it. But actually, I want to show you that it doesn't happen in graphene. So now let's do it more carefully. Yeah, so the difference in graphene is that we have this alpha and beta, and that we know that our dispersion is this Dirac cone. So let's first think about this this quantity. I'm already taking into account these two delta functions. they should hold in graphene as well. So I have CK sigma alpha, CK sigma beta. And let me ask you, what is this expectation value? So now I take, my probe is such. I have the ground state of graphene. And this is the part where I'm not doing it self-consistently, because I'm calculating it at the ground state of the non-interacting system. If you wanted to do it self-consistently, you have to put here the interacting ground state and then solve again. Or not the interacting ground state, because we don't really know it, but you would put the variational ground state. Do you all know what I'm talking about when I talk about the self-consistent thing? See, this is what John did. Basically, calculate this expectation value in a quadratic system that has some unknown dispersion, some EK, CK, dagger, CK, and then minimize with respect to parameters of this dispersion. But we're actually just taking the ground state of the non-interacting, so let me put a zero here. So what is the expectation value? Remember, I have this ground state. I put all of my electrons the way you told me to, without polarization. What is the expectation value of this density operator?
Simply the distribution function.
Yeah, okay, so let's say it's zero temperature. At zero temperature, what's the distribution function at zero temperature?
One
or zero. So is this one? So, okay. I have two indices here. Why don't I have a delta alpha beta? Let me ask you this. I did a delta sigma sigma prime because I said you cannot take an electron with spin up and return an electron with spin down and still think you're in the same state. That will just not happen because spin is a good quantum number. All of my eigenstates have a definite spin. But that's not true for these alpha and beta. I can take an electron from site A, put an electron on site B, and there is still some overlap with the function I started with the many body function I started with. And the reason for that is that these alpha and beta are not good quantum numbers. My Hamiltonian does not preserve the number of spins, the number of electrons on A sublattice versus B sublattice. It actually moves, it hops things from A to B. My Hamiltonian is diagonal in another basis, in the lower upper cone basis. But every eigenstate that I have in my Hamiltonian is actually a combination of alpha and beta. So there's no delta alpha beta. What there is let's say these are both A sublattice. Then no problem, right? You know what it's going to be. So let's write it as a matrix. When they're both A, then I take an electron out of the A site with momentum K and spin up, and then I return the same electron. I didn't do anything. I should get the same state back. So I put a 1, okay? 1, and I have to put here some theta function that tells me that my chemical potential, or whatever, however you want to call it, is larger than the energy of this K. And I also put an index S here. So what I mean by S is to tell you if we're in the upper cone or lower cone. So if I had a Fermi surface, it's enough to just look at K Fermi and say everything below K Fermi is populated, everything outside of K Fermi is not populated. This is different, so if I'm assuming that there's some chemical potential here, then whatever is below here has actually a larger chemical potential, a larger K Fermi, but here it's different. If I had my K Fermi here, it would be anything that has smaller K Fermi. But you know what I mean by that. I just mean, tell me first if the state is populated, and then I'll tell you what is the probability. So if I take and return an electron with the same, on the same sublattice, no problem. But if I extract an electron from A site and return it to the B site, I did not end up with the same state that I started with, but there is some overlap. And the overlap is exactly this e to the I phi k. So do you remember that our wave functions were something like 1 over root 2, 1 e to the I phi k? So if I take something, say on A, and then return it on B, there would be this overlap between wave functions. And I forgot there's a normalization here. 1 over root 2. And if I do the opposite, I'll get e to the minus I phi k. Okay? So this is this quantity. You can call it the density matrix. So we already talked about the Green's functions. The density matrix are kind of related, but it's sort of like a same time Green's function, but it's written as density, so the operators are commuted. And basically, all I'm telling you is that the density itself could be an operator if I have a degree of freedom that is not that my system is not diagonal in. Of course, if I diagonalized first, then I would just have the diagonal pieces. Okay, so I have this, and now what I want to do is rewrite this in a different way. So the exchange energy is now so I'm taking advantage of the delta functions already, and I have V k minus k prime. Yeah, I guess before it was just q here, and I didn't know it until I had the delta functions. So let's say it's actually ns of k and sigma, and now I mean this theta function when I write this n. Okay, so it's a theta function. And n sigma, and I have only one sigma here, of k prime s prime. So I could have definitely states from different, since I didn't start with anything diagonal, there are two options here, that either I do this in the lower cone or in the upper cone. So I give this cone index, if you want, upper or lower cone, times, so I'll have sum over alpha and beta of this matrix for this expectation value, and then another matrix with k prime here and s prime for this expectation value. And it's actually a trace of the following matrix, e to the I phi k, e to the minus I phi k, 1, 1, e to the I phi k prime, e to the minus I phi k prime. And if you want, I can actually write it in a different way. I can just write it as k, k prime sigma, v, k, k prime, s, s prime. Just put everything in there, n sigma s and sigma s prime. And what is this v of k? It's basically v of k minus k prime that I had. Let's just give it maybe another name. Times, and now I want to take the trace, so the product of this matrix gives me, on the diagonal, I have 1 times 1 and this times this, so I have 1 plus e to the I phi k minus I k prime, and the other element on the diagonal is the 2, 2, so it's plus e to the minus I phi k plus I phi k prime plus 1, and I have 1 over, I have a half here. So it's basically, here I will have those theta functions, so let's say theta s of, let's just call it n like before, not to make a mess here, so n sigma s and sigma prime. And sigma s prime of, I'm just calculating v, I don't need n. So I just have here 1 plus cosine of phi k minus phi k prime. Yeah. I have a sum over alpha and beta. So I basically have alpha, beta, some matrix. Alpha beta, some matrix beta alpha. So this beta sum just tells me I need to multiply matrices, and this sum tells me I need to take a trace. Any more?
Yeah, so what happens to the point when you look at the theta of mu minus ek?
Yeah, so I still have it here. These are my n's. So basically, what this is telling me is that I have to find the interaction, which depends on whether the two states, the two brackets here, are which cones they belong to. So it depends on S and S prime. And then for each one of them, I have to ask whether it's populated. So I need two states that are populated in order to interact. They could be either in the lower or upper cone. And the interaction between them depends on k, but also, there's one very interesting thing I forgot. It also depends on S and S prime. And if you remember, I derived this matrix because I looked at this eigenvector. However, the sign here depends on whether we're in the upper or lower cone. Because if we were in the lower cone, I have to put a minus sign. So I have actually S here, which even S and S prime, so it propagates all the way, and what I get here is an important factor of 1 plus S, S prime cosine phi k minus phi k prime. So now you see that the interaction here in this case is very different from the interaction in a Fermi liquid. It looks like the interaction cares about the chirality. So it's a recurring theme here. Even in the scattering processes of impurities, we said that the scattering process has some dependence on chirality because the amplitude for one state to go into another state depended on chirality, of overlap of wave function. It's very similar here, even though it's densities. So even though the density itself, the density that we measure, might not depend on chirality, the interaction knows about it because it knows which momentum we start and end with. And the chirality is tied to the momentum. So now, let me assume that this interaction is a Coulomb interaction. And in two dimensions, the Coulomb interactions looks like, I think it's 2 pi here, K minus K prime, K minus K prime. And don't worry, there's no singularity because we do not take Q equals zero, and Q is the difference between those. So now what I want to do to see what is the state, I want to know what this interaction, exchange interaction, is doing. What does it want to do? Does it want to polarize or not? So let me think that this V is maximized in some way. So I know that my vectors, K and K prime, are pretty close to one another. Okay? And therefore, those phis are pretty close. So let's just forget about the cosine. It's more or less 1. Okay? But I also have the S and S prime indices. And I need to go over everything that's populated. So assume that, you know, because of the interaction, there is some difference in population. There is some, let me say it in another way. We start with full Dirac cone for up and full Dirac cone for down. Now, if I want to create a ferromagnetic state, it means that I will have less down than up, or the other way around. So there is some Fermi surface, that Fermi level, that is not zero. And there would be, therefore, some interactions between electrons here and electrons here, because they're both populated. So there would be two kinds of interactions. Same chirality interaction, either both here, it looks like both should be negative, or different. However, when S is different than S prime, and remember, S is just a sign, I just get a minus sign. So my interaction is roughly zero. So what this tells me is that this is not a good way to lower the energy by adding exchange energy. So even though in the Fermi liquid, you gain a lot of exchange energy by just polarizing the system, here, even if I slightly polarize, it doesn't give me anything because the main contribution to the interaction is just going to vanish. So therefore, actually, graphene does not want to order ferromagnetically. And what we did here is kind of a sketch, but even if you go to higher order and do a random phase of approximation, I don't know if you have covered that with John, you see that the tendency for ferromagnetism, surprisingly, actually diminishes as you increase the interaction strength.
So do we have a long range order in the ground state?
No. No long range order here. Let me tell you more than that. So this is, I spoke about spin, but actually we have more copies of that. So I have also, let's say this was K valley. I have also K prime valley. And I did not include interactions that scatter us from K to K prime. And I think it's okay since we know that K minus K prime, the momentum needs to be relatively close in a Coulomb interaction. In other types of interaction, yeah, maybe we have to consider that. But if there's no long-range, momentum transfer, then it's okay. But I can play the same game also saying that I might want to put more electrons in K rather than K prime. So here, actually, the role of spin and the role of valley are going to be quite identical. So the rigorous way to say it would be to give a K Fermi separately to each one of them and then see what is the dependent on K Fermi. Can I increase the energy by making K Fermis different? And the answer is no, because whenever you create a situation that you're away from half filling in one of the cones, you don't gain anything. So the interaction just doesn't, is not minimized this way. And actually, this leads you to think that, roughly speaking, even though, you know, this is not exactly one and we didn't really do everything self-consistently, but roughly speaking, graphene would like to just stay at its own ground state, its non-interacting ground state, even with interactions. That doesn't say that the interactions don't do anything. One thing that the interactions do, and I'll just briefly mention, is basically change, renormalize the velocity and makes it even larger than what it is. So I don't know how to draw it. So it makes it kind of look like that. This is a velocity renormalization. And if you remember, I showed you a slide of an experiment in the first lecture that was an ARPIS experiment. So ARPIS measures precisely this this dispersion, and it looked there like there was a gap. But actually, if you look closely at the data, you saw that there are some states in the gap, very concentrated at zero momentum. So one can interpret this gap as coming from the interactions. It's still an open question. This is my point of view. Another point of view is that the gap actually comes from sublattice-induced imbalance between the A and B. Substrate-induced imbalance between the A and B. So let me just say maybe briefly what that amounts to. So if I have kx plus iky, kx minus iky, if I put anything on the diagonal, this is not a mass term. This is just a constant shift. But if I have some imbalance between A and B, I can write it like that. It's like putting a potential on A and B sublattices, and the potential is not equal. If you look at what the spectrum of this thing is, it's gapped. It has m squared plus k squared. So you created a gap. So in that way, a substrate that discriminates between the A and the B sublattices is going to open a gap that might look similar to that, but I don't know then how to explain the states that you see here. So it could be that we're seeing the effect of interactions in this feature that might look like a gap. Yeah?
Is there a finite system size case when it does
that? Yeah. So finite size effects usually leads to gaps in a very simple way, is that you cannot, your momentum indices are discrete. If we go to a large system, we can talk about continuum. But when it's small enough, they're discrete. There are 2 pi over n a times n, right? And n goes from minus n to n, or minus n to n or something like that. So then you might miss the Dirac point. But that's a different kind of gap. It's not a gap that's there because of interactions. But yeah, and you see that even in nanotubes. So you can think of a nanotube as graphene, a strip of graphene with periodic boundary conditions. So often in nanotubes, you don't see a Dirac point at all. Yeah, that's a good point. I also must say that one can engineer the interactions in different ways. So if it's not the Coulomb interaction, and somehow we manage to induce interaction, you can imagine that you have induced maybe only a nearest neighbor interaction. So that our V of R there is only non-zero when R is the A to B vector. This actually leads to a charge density wave. This favors an ordered state where more electrons are on the A sublattice rather than the B sublattice, and this gives a gap of this kind. There's also spin orbit interactions. We're going to talk about it. It can also induce a gap. It doesn't really happen in graphene. It's just too small. Yeah.
How do you experimentally go about changing these interactions?
So one thing that is very easy to do is to change the Fermi level. Another thing that's not so easy but just happens is a substrate effect. So you can imagine putting this on silicon, which is amorphous. Maybe on average nothing happens. But if you put it on something that silicon carbide has a similar lattice structure. But it's two different, the A and B sublattices are two different atoms. So then you will induce exactly this kind of gap. It's like you can think of the substrate as just inducing some potential upwards if it's underneath. Another proposal that I've been involved with in the context of topological insulators was to put a metallic gate over everything, not let it transfer electrons, but let it interact. And then somehow the interactions in the metal induce interactions in the graphene. So you can do that. I think that's more complicated. You can induce maybe magnetic fields. That's sometimes the case where you just put a ferromagnet underneath your sample. Yeah. Okay, so I think I'm more or less done, unless you have more questions. Okay.
So, my friends, please take your homework. That was the answer to a certain degree tutorial. I will probably put the tutorial on the wiki at the end of today, say around 5, 6 o'clock. I decided to do this because probably some of you